Welcome to El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine. International Federation of Clinical Chemistry, IFCC. Executive Director, Dr. Hernan Ferres-Tayeb.
Member of the Committee of Evidence-Based Laboratory Medicine of the International Federation of Clinical Chemistry.
Organizing Committee, Dr. Maria Montserrat Blanes Gonzalez from Paraguay, Dr. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico, and Dr. Estela Raimondo from Uruguay.
El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry.
El Microscopio, where health professionals can meet over the internet.
We are thankful to the audience. We have more than 100,300 Facebook likes. Let's go for more.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
The Spanish Association of Pharmaceutical Analysts and the Chilean Society of Clinical Chemistry accompany El Microscopio.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Professor Yehuda Schoenfeld is the founder and director of the Zalabuzwa Wick Center for Autoimmune Diseases at the Sheba Medical Center, which is affiliated to the Sackler Faculty of Medicine in Tel Aviv University, Israel. Professor Schoenfeld is chair for research of autoimmune diseases at the Tel Aviv University. His clinical and scientific works focus on autoimmune and rheumatic diseases.
Professor Yehuda Schoenfeld, welcome to Microscopio. In this interview, we wanted to talk about autoimmune autoinflammatory syndrome induced by adjuvants. What is this syndrome and what conditions are included?
So we have to start the interview by discussing who are the people and how are the people developing autoimmune diseases. Autoimmune diseases are diseases in which there is hyperactivity of the immune system instead of being directed against foreign invaders like viruses, bacteria, and so forth, it is redirected or misdirected against our own tissues and organs. And this is autoimmune diseases. Now, the autoimmune disease, by and large, all of them are genetic, but just genetics is not enough to develop autoimmune disease. So almost always you can find another member, first-degree relative of the patients who suffers from one of the autoimmune diseases, and by and large, it is usually autoimmune thyroid disease because this is the most prevalent autoimmune disease in nature. So genetic by itself is not enough to develop the disease. You need a trigger, which is usually environmental factors, which will combine together with the genetics to induce the autoimmune disease. There are many environmental factors. They might be infectious, like the EB virus, the kissing disease virus, the infectious mononucleosis, which is responsible for more than 33 different autoimmune diseases, as well as other bacteria like Helicobacter pylori, but also some drugs, and therefore we have drug-induced lupus, drug-induced myasthenia gravis, and also additional factors in the environment. Now, basically, those factors which are involved in inducing autoimmune disease in those who are genetically prone for it, they have two characteristics. One is that they can stimulate the immune system, being adjuvants, which comes from the word in Latin, adjuvare, to help, or they have molecular mimicry to body constituents. The molecular mimicry means or is the reason why we attack or one the specific organ is attacked by the immune system, because it's similar to the structure in the bacteria or in the foreign substance. Now, this is the basic word for the ASIA syndrome, autoimmune diseases induced by adjuvant. This means that there are some substances which behave like adjuvants, and I will detail them in a few minutes, which stimulate the immune system to induce autoimmune disease in those who are genetically prone for them. Now, where do we have adjuvants? So, definitely, in some of the vaccines, we have adjuvants. So it's not surprising that some of the vaccines which contain specifically aluminum as adjuvant, which is the strongest adjuvant we have, it's a foreign substance, foreign metal, which the companies are using in many vaccines for more than 100 years. It's very cheap, and they are not interested in changing it or replacing it. So this aluminium in the vaccine, if it comes in contact, it means that the subject to be vaccinated belongs to those who are genetically prone, and we can detect them. Those people will develop the autoimmune diseases induced by adjuvant, the Asia syndrome. This means that if we know who are those people by different genetic marker, we can progress into personalized medicine. Namely, not all the vaccines are actually proper to all the people. Another very interesting adjuvant is silicone breast implants. The silicone was selected because of its constituents or its filling, which remind the filling of the body, and it was believed that it is inert to the immune system. It does not react with the immune system. But it was found not to be true. The silicone is bleeding constantly from the wrapping, and we can find the silicone sometimes in lymph nodes of the inguinal area. When it ruptures or when it infiltrates, it can infiltrate the lungs. It has been found that the silicone per se actually stimulates the immune system and behave like adjuvant. We have additional adjuvants in the world. Even infections, many of the bacteria actually induce autoimmune diseases because they contain adjuvant in their structure. God most probably provided them with the adjuvant to protect us so that the immune system will be able to react and to expel them. But once they have this adjuvant, they stimulate the immune system. For instance, following the 9/11 terrorist attack on the Twin Towers in New York, it has been found that there were many people working on the reconstructions, which contains a lot of aluminum. Following 2 years after this reconstruction, many of those workers being exposed to the aluminum, which is an adjuvant, developed different and diverse autoimmune diseases. So in summary, the Asia syndrome comes to explain why we develop autoimmune diseases, why specifically some people develop autoimmune diseases, and why some substances in the environment that we are exposed to them are actually the stimulants that determines who will develop the diseases, and actually when they will develop the diseases.
And what adjuvants commonly used in vaccine or in medical practice have been used in the autoimmune syndrome induced by adjuvants? Are there any other adjuvants associated with this syndrome?
As I mentioned, there are additional adjuvants in the air as well as in vaccine. There are some vaccines which have different adjuvants, and they are also notorious. Having said that, there are ideas in the literature how to develop new adjuvants that will be less harmful. But as I mentioned before, by and large, the companies producing the vaccines, they are not so much interested to replace the effective and cheap aluminum, especially that they get a backup from many administrators and health caregivers, which says that no, vaccine never causes autoimmune diseases. And I hope that in the future more effort and more budget will be diverted to generate less harmful adjuvants.
What is the clinical case of the syndrome? And what are the main clinical and systemic manifestations?
So the clinical picture is actually what we call a pre-dom of autoimmune diseases. Autoimmune diseases do not start immediately as a full-blown syndrome with all the clinical manifestation. Actually, at the very early beginning, quite often it's difficult to determine what is the diagnosis. So many of these patients, they do suffer from joint pains, muscle pains, and especially extreme fatigue. Basically, it reminds very much the chronic fatigue syndrome. And the reason is that the aluminum, for instance, which is swallowed by cells which are called phagocytes, they are transferred like a Trojan horse to the brain, and they induce a kind of inflammation and reaction. And this is the reason why many of the complaints following this ASIA syndrome are neurological. One of them is called POTS, post-orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. It means that when you stand up, you feel dizzy and unstable. Actually, many of the patients with a chronic fatigue syndrome also suffer from these complaints. There are autoimmune diseases, full-blown diseases, neurological, which are induced by the vaccines and the adjuvants. Many of those patients will develop autoantibodies, the markers of autoimmune diseases, which are used for diagnosis. At the beginning, there is no specificity for those autoantibodies. After a long incubation time, many of those who develop the ASIA syndrome will evolve to one of the well-characterized autoimmune diseases like lupus, myasthenia gravis, Crohn's disease, and so forth.
Which are the criteria used for the diagnosis of the autoimmune syndrome induced by adjuvants, and how do we make the diagnosis with other autoimmune diseases?
The idea is that basically the physician or the health giver has to ask the question whether there is a time relationship to the vaccine or whether the patient, for instance, has a silicone breast implant or other silicone implants. Second, what are the clinical manifestations which are characterized by fatigue, myalgia, which is muscle pains, arthralgia, joint pains. Sometimes we can see even an inflammation of the joints, which is called arthritis. Many of the sufferers suffer from inflammatory bowel syndrome, namely diarrhea and abdominal pains. Then we suffer from dry eyes, which is also quite typical to this case. And in the laboratory, we will find, as I mentioned, non-specific clinical or laboratory findings like autoantibodies, which not necessarily will be specific to one or another autoimmune disease. So the combination and the relationship to the inciting factor and the clinical manifestation, as well as the laboratory markers, alludes to the diagnosis of ASIA syndrome.
Would you like to make any final comment about this topic?
I hope that physicians will be more aware to this complication and will not neither neglect them nor reject them, because these people suffer a lot and they wander from one physician to another so that the diagnosis will be recognized. And it is not recognized. It's a new syndrome, and the literature are becoming more and more aware of it. And definitely these subjects who suffer continuously should be treated. We have published also papers about some ideas of therapies in this case. Having said that, if the patient developed a full-blown, well-characterized autoimmune disease, the disease should be, the treatment should be the same as the counterpart disease without the ASIA syndrome.
Thank you very much, Professor Schoenfeld. It's been a pleasure to have this interview.
It was my best pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.
We are in El Microscopio, a program about clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine.
Well, I tried to make it Sunday, but I got so damn depressed that I set my sights on Monday and I got myself undressed. Now, I ain't ready for the altar, but I do agree there's times when a woman sure can be a good friend of mine. Well, I keep on thinking about you, sister, golden hair surprise. And I just can't live without you. Can't you see it in my eyes? Now, I've been one poor correspondent. Well, I've been too hard to find. But it doesn't mean, girl, you ain't been on my mind. I don't mind saying, I just can't make it. Well, I keep on thinking about you, sister, golden hair surprise. Just can't live without you. Well, can't you see it in my eyes? Now, I've been one poor correspondent, but I've been too hard to find. But it doesn't mean, girl, you ain't been. I don't mind saying, I just can't make it.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Alberto Barrantes in Costa Rica. Álvaro Justiniano Gross in Bolivia. Ana Leticia Maselli in Guatemala. Carmen Cecilia Almonacid Urrego in Colombia. Cristina Cerveto from Uruguay. Eduardo Aranda in Chile. Graciela Velázquez from Paraguay. María del Carmen Pasquel from Ecuador.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Professor Maria Inés Pinto Sánchez is postdoctoral clinical research fellow at McMaster University at the Health Sciences Center, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada.
Professor Maria Inés Pinto, welcome to El Microscopio.
So thank you so much, Valen, for inviting me to talk about this very important topic.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about celiac disease. And we know that the Nutrition Committee of the European Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology and Nutrition has recommended avoiding the introduction of gluten before the age of 4 months and after the age of 7 months. What is your opinion about that recommendation?
So first of all, please let me comment on what it's all about and where these recommendations came from. You know that celiac disease is a really common condition that affects that 1% of population, and that 30% of overall population in the worldwide have the genetic predisposition for being celiac. But because not everybody developed the condition, so there must be other environmental factors that may contribute to the risk for celiac disease.
And this is why different factors, for example, the time that gluten was introduced to the children, and also breastfeeding, and also the amount of gluten that is introduced, that were some factors that were noticed as to contribute to the development of the condition. There has been so many studies for the last 40 years, regarding the risk factors for celiac disease. And the EFGAN and other pediatric associations recommended to perform different recommendations based on the evidence. And recently the EFGAN recommended to avoid introducing gluten before the 4th month of age and after the 7 months. So they recommended to introduce gluten in a window period of 4 to 6 months in the children. So, and that gluten should be introduced gradually in small quantities rather than suddenly and big quantities. And they also recommended to maintain the breastfeeding if possible. And these recommendations were based on what the evidence was available, but because all this data is changing and new studies are emerging, so then we decided to perform a meta-analysis, a systematic review, which is reviewing all literature available for the last years and pulling all data to assess what the recommendations are and be able to help for future guidelines. What we saw is that this current recommendation of the EFGAN to introduce gluten within the period of 4 to 6 months was still valid according to our data, but we were not able to find any increase in risk for celiac disease while introducing gluten earlier. So it seems that the period of the EFGAN that EFGAN suggested is still valid. However, there are so many studies coming, and so all this data is changing.
According to your work, Gluten Introduction to Infant Feeding and Risk of Celiac Disease, Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis, what is the ideal timing of gluten introduction?
So in our study, we analyzed different periods for gluten introduction. And let me confess that it was difficult at the beginning to find the period, what the ideal period was, because all studies available analyze different periods of time. So what we did is we assessed the gluten introduction earlier, which means we define earlier as less than 4 months versus late gluten introduction, so which is introducing gluten after 7 months, and also compared to the recommended time for gluten introduction, which was between the period of 4 to 6 months. And there are different studies evaluating any of these periods. We found two randomized controlled trials, which is the highest evidence for studies. Two of them assessed a period of 6 to 12 months, and the others were studies which are called observational, assessing either earlier or later. And what we found when we assessed this data was that later introduction of gluten, so after 7 months, but not earlier introduction of gluten, was associated with an increased risk for celiac disease of 25%. So this was surprising because the current guidelines recommend not to introduce gluten also early, and we didn't find any evidence supporting this. But as I said before, this data is changing and also new studies are emerging. So even though our findings were surprising in terms of early, I think the later introduction of gluten and the recommended are still persistent. So it goes according to the EFGAN guidelines.
And we wanted to ask you about some recommendations. I will read them and ask for your opinion about them. The introduction of gluten at 6 months versus the introduction of gluten at 12 months.
Okay, so this period of time was assessed only for these randomized controlled trials, which are the highest evidence, so the highest evidence for studies. And at these time points, because there were only two randomized controlled trials, when we pull the data, so when we put all data together, we couldn't find any difference in terms of risk for celiac disease at this period. But then we did with the other periods.
And the introduction of gluten after 4 months versus the recommended time 4 to 6 months or later, more than 6 months.
Okay, so these two time periods, so earlier introduction versus later, or earlier introduction versus recommended. So as I said before, so this period of time were evaluated for observational studies, and we were not able to find any increased risk for celiac disease when we assess it earlier introduction of gluten. This means less than 4 months versus recommended introduction of gluten, which is 4 to 6 months, or earlier versus later, which is less than 4 months versus more than 7 months. However, when we assessed the observational studies available, which were around 12 of them, and in terms of late, when we compare later introduction of gluten versus the recommended time, we found an increased risk of celiac disease in this specific period of 25%. And so these were from observational studies.
And what about the introduction of gluten at other time points?
So other time points were assessed in different studies, like, you know, studies were assessing the introduction of gluten 2 months, at 3 months, at 4, at 6, at 7, 9 months. But we, because any of these studies define these time points differently, it was difficult to pull all data. So what we did is to allocate all these studies and before or after the period recommended. So right now we are not able through our meta-analysis to suggest any beneficial effect at any of the other time points that the individual studies assessed. Because what we did with our meta-analysis is to pull the data in order to be able what is the current evidence in this period of time.
What gluten dose and mode of introduction present less risk to develop celiac disease?
Well, I think this is a crucial question, and actually this is what all investigators around the world are going to. Gluten dose and the moment of gluten introduction, and the mode actually of gluten introduction, that this means gradual introduction versus sudden introduction, or even while the children is still breastfeeding or not, are other potential contributors to develop the risk for celiac disease. Unfortunately, when we did the meta-analysis, we found only two studies evaluating the effect of amount of gluten introduction. And these two studies differ in the amount of gluten, they introduce gluten. So we were not able to pull the data for our study. We were not able to retrieve any or draw any conclusion regarding our meta-analysis because of these studies were too heterogeneous. However, after we published this meta-analysis, there was another big study, large study, recently published by the Swedish, that show that even if you introduce gradually gluten into an infant's diet, this child can still develop celiac disease suddenly. So, and in this study, which is really new and it was published after our results, children that were early diagnosed with celiac disease had a lower consumption of gluten at 6 months of age than controls. But when they consume larger amounts of gluten at age of, for example, 1 or 2 years, because there were some people that these 2 points, 1 and 2 years, were assessed at this in this study, so they did not develop. So they did not develop celiac disease. So it seems that the amount of gluten consumption matters, but apparently in the period of time that we were wondering whether this increased the risk for celiac, which is the 4 to 6 months, they didn't see a positive effect or negative effect for the risk. So which means that we need more studies in this area, and this is where we should focus on now.
What would be the effect of breastfeeding at the time of gluten introduction and risk of celiac disease?
Breastfeeding was another factor that I think most pediatricians and clinicians around the world put emphasis. And this is because of the protective effect of breastfeeding, or the beneficial effect in general. And there were some studies in the past suggesting that breastfeeding, so if gluten was introduced when when the children was breastfeeding, or if the children was breastfeeding for a longer period of time, so then it may have a protective effect in the development for celiac disease. However, when we analyzed all these studies available, and we found that there were some contradictory results. So some studies suggested a protective effect for breastfeeding, and some others did not. And the problem that we had is that when we analyzed the data, we found that these studies were so heterogeneous in terms of the design and the period of time that kids were breastfeeding. So we had difficulties in pulling all data. However, we were successful in pulling the data. But when we did that, we did not find any difference or any increased risk for breastfeeding for children who were breastfeeding versus those who were not breastfeeding. So we were not able to draw any conclusion on any protective effect of breastfeeding in for celiac disease.
Our next question was, breastfeeding is beneficial in many ways, but whether it also helps reduce the risk of celiac disease is unclear. Could you please share your opinion on this issue?
I think it's in terms of opinion, it's fine, because it's, as we suggested in our, as we draw in our discussion, so even though, you know, there is no solid evidence of a protective effect for breastfeeding, pediatricians, I think they draw and there is a consensus that breastfeeding is supporting for the children in general. So the American Academy of Pediatrics also support the exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months. So we are going to remain with this recommendation, and as we did in the last part of our meta-analysis, we maintain this until there is any more clear result coming from new studies.
Whether 100 milligrams is the optimal amount of gluten to introduce at age of 4 months is unclear. It is also possible that a greater amount or a gradually increasing amount starting at 4 months may be needed as protective. What amount of gluten could be introduced?
So when we, as explained in the previous question, so when we analyze the amount of gluten that will be introduced for children, and this was a really interest for us, we were not able to find any, we were not able to draw any conclusion regarding the studies available, because most of the studies did not address this issue. There is a consensus for pediatricians and the recommendation based on the EFGAN and the other associations in pediatrics that the amount of gluten that needs to be introduced needs to be low, and 100 milligrams is low. And so at that moment, we didn't have much evidence. So we were sticking with the recommendations, current recommendations, from the pediatrician societies. However, after this new study was published a month ago from the Swedish authors, they analyzed this subset of patients from this big cohort of children at risk for diabetes, and also they assessed the risk for celiac disease. And they involved thousands of children. And what they did is they analyzed specific cohorts of 146 Swedish children and compared with another 436 or 30-something controls. And they found that for each additional gram of gluten that was consumed per day before the celiac disease was expressed, so then the risk for celiac disease will increase in 28%. And also that these children that were receiving larger amount of gluten, so more than 5 grams, which is 50 times more than 100 milligrams, so during these first 2 years, they had an increased risk for celiac disease of 3-fold more. So, which means that as much gluten as the children are introducing, specifically in this period of time, is worse. So, and what was very interesting in this last study also is that neither the breastfeeding or the age of gluten introduce a matter. So we are, the amount, although this is this study is promising, and we don't have a clear, very clear amount or a specific amount. What seems clear is that as much gluten as children are introduced is worse. So we are sticking with the recommendation for the pediatrician of introducing lower amount of gluten, so starting with 100 milligrams and introducing gradually until we have a better or more clear study suggesting the opposite or confirming this.
And considering that infants ingest an average of approximately 5 grams of gluten daily between the age of 7 and 12 months, it seems reasonable to introduce gluten in the amount of 1.2 grams daily at the age of 6 months and continue this dose for roughly 4 weeks, then increase the consumption to 2.5 grams per day at 7 to 8 months, and finally to 5 grams per day up to the age of 12 months. After the age of 12 months, a full regular amount of gluten might be acceptable. Is there any evidence suggesting that gluten limitation can delay the onset of celiac disease?
This statement of the way that gluten should be introduced, as I mentioned before, was generated by the consensus of expert pediatricians. And this was added at the end of our study because of the lack of evidence on the topic. But I think we need more information before we can, we need more studies to support this or to confirm or to prove the opposite. And regarding the limitation or the delay of the onset of celiac disease, I think there are other studies suggesting that children with high risk for celiac disease that limit the quantity of gluten may delay the development of celiac disease. And this is another problem related to the studies because then if the risk for celiac disease is not abolished but delayed, so then it means that we need longer follow-up period for the studies to better estimate the risk. And this is a possibility, and I think we need to account for this in the future. There are very few studies, I think it's one or two, suggesting that this celiac disease may be delayed rather than abolished in terms of risk. Well, I think it's a take-home message for people what is the evidence available now or in terms of risk factors for celiac disease. What has been studied recently is the age of gluten introduction and breastfeeding. And it seems that they both, the age of gluten introduction and breastfeeding may contribute, but not as much as we thought before. If there is any effect, according to our meta-analysis, it may be with a late introduction of gluten increasing the risk for celiac. But we need larger studies to determine this and to confirm this result. And in terms of the amount of gluten introduced to childhood, it seems that the amount of gluten matters, but the exact amount of gluten and in which period of time, if it is in this window period for 4 to 6 months, or if it is later on, as suggested by the latest study, like 1 to 2 years, is still unclear. So if it is unclear, it is unclear also if the risk, this risk changed over the time, or if the introduction of gluten delayed the disease rather than preventing it. So I think we need more studies to confirm this.
Thank you very much, Professor Maria Inés Pinto Sánchez. Thank you very much for this very interesting interview.
Thank you so much, Belén.
El Microscopio, where health professionals can meet over the Internet.
If the night turned cold and the stars looked down, you'd hug yourself on the cold, cold ground. You wake the morning in a stranger's coat, but no one would you see. You'd ask yourself, who'd watch for me? My only friend, who could it be? It's hard to say it, I hate to say it, but it's probably me. When your belly's empty and the hunger's so real, you're too proud to beg and too dumb to steal. You
search the city for your only friend, but no one will you see. Ask yourself, who'd watch for me? A solitary voice to speak out and set me free. I hate to say it, I hate to say it, but it's probably me. You're not the easiest person I ever got to know. It was hard for us both, but that I feel unsure. Some would say I should let you go your way, you only make me cry. But if there's one guy, just one guy, who laid down his life for you and I, I hate to say it, I hate to say it, but it's probably me.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico, José Jara from Peru, Milagros de la Rosa from Dominican Republic, Miriam Aguilera from Honduras, Rafael Calafel from Spain, Mario Chavez Villalobos from Costa Rica, Dante Janias from Bolivia, Leverton Ortiz from Chile.
El Microscopio. Agenda. Offering courses, workshops, seminars, congresses.
Agenda. The 9th Palestinian Conference of Laboratory Medicine in Ramallah, Palestine, from August the 11th to August the 13th, 2016. 58th National Conference of the Hungarian Society of Laboratory Medicine in Hungary, from August 25th to August 27th, 2016.
Agenda.
The Benefits and Challenges of Point-of-Care Testing Across the Clinical Spectrum, 26th International CPOCT Symposium in Copenhagen, Denmark, from September 21st to September 24th, 2016.
Agenda.
The SPC, ML and IFC Joint Symposium in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, on September 29th, 2016.
Agenda.
The First Scientific and Professional Congress of Cordoba, Argentina, Congress of Biochemistry, 2016. October the 4th to October the 8th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 2016 Conference of the Association of Clinical Chemists of Nigeria, in Nigeria in October the 12th to October the 14th, 2016. The 48th National Congress of Laboratory Medicine, the patient's central role between laboratory and clinical practice in Torino, Italy, from October the 18th to October the 20th, 2016.
Agenda.
The 10th National Congress of Clinical Laboratory in Zaragoza, Spain, from October the 19th to October 21st, 2016.
Agenda.
The joint meeting of the 3rd Congress of Controversies in Thrombosis and Hemostasis and the 8th Russian Conference of Clinical Hemocytology and Hemorrhagy in Moscow, Russia, from October the 20th to October 22nd, 2016.
El Microscopio.
IFCC affiliates with Clinica Chimica Acta, the CCA, as the official journal of IFCC. The IFCC is delighted to be able to partner with Elsevier in agreement that makes Clinica Chimica Acta the official journal of IFCC. Elsevier has an outstanding reputation as an international publisher in the field of medicine and healthcare, with a huge range of leading titles in both journals and books. This experience will be of benefit to IFCC as we strive to increase our scientific and public relations image at a global level. In reaching the agreement, IFCC was encouraged by the vision and the commitment of Elsevier to advance the quality and impact of IFCC publications. In the years to come, Elsevier and CCA will continue to do their best to facilitate and publicize IFCC activities to enable the Federation to be as effective as possible. As part of this agreement with IFCC, all individual members of IFCC full and affiliate national societies will now be entitled, from the beginning of 2014, to receive low-cost online access to the journal, including archives back to the first issue in 1956. The coordination of this member subscription of $35 per year will be carried out by each society on behalf of its members. More details will be sent shortly to the IFCC National Society representatives.
El Microscopio, an online radio program about biochemistry.
Exciting and inviting me.
El Microscopio, where health professionals can meet over the internet.
We are thankful to the audience. We have more than 100,300 Facebook likes. Let's go for more.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world. Our correspondents in every country. Stella Raimondo from Uruguay. Fernando Ruiz Cerda from Chile, Montserrat González from Paraguay, Isabel Fierro from Ecuador, José Francisco Valle from Mexico, Oswaldo Ruiz Narváez from Costa Rica, Patrocinio Truecas from Spain, Rodolfo Aquino Cáceres from El Salvador.
This is El Microscopio.
On infobioquimica.org.
News. IFCC, the leading organization in the field of clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine, worldwide announces that the electronic journal of the IFCC has been accepted by the National Library of Medicine for indexing in Medline PubMed. All issues of the journal will be indexed and searchable, downloadable, citable from PubMed in the near future. Dr. Khosrow Wadeli, IFCC Communications and Publications Division's Chair, says this is an important step forward for IFCC as PubMed indexes significantly improve access to EJ IFCC articles and will promote IFCC internationally.
Or microscopio.
The IFCC Executive Board has agreed to introduce the IFCC Medal for Outstanding Service in recognition of sustained service to IFCC by an individual at the highest level in promoting the international practice of clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine. The first award of the medal will be made in 2017, and nominations are now being sought with a closing date of 31st December 2016. Nominations for the medal should be submitted by the IFCC member to the IFCC secretary by December 31st each year. Nominations should comprise a letter of nomination on headed notepaper, which explains the outstanding international contribution made by the nominee, a copy of the curriculum vitae of the nominee.
El Microscopio.
Mexico City hosted the second IFCC symposium on biomarkers in Alzheimer's disease at the Hotel Camino Real Polanco on May the 20th, 2016. It was a top-class conference with more than 70 attendees and an excellent scientific program. In summary, said Dr. Sierra Amor and Dr. Bernardini, that we could say that probably we are on the right path, but we need to talk more and more about dementia disorders and strongly support research and educational programs all around the world. We need to become aware of an actual health problem, identifying properly Alzheimer's disease patients and other pathologies related to dementia.
Where can you find further information? We at El Microscopio upload news about publications, websites, and institutions.
Mama.
so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah, I have finally seen the light, and I have finally realized what you mean.
The team of El Microscopio. Hernan Ferres Taye.
Hernan Ferres Taye.
Silvana Bujan.
Silvana Bujan.
Nicolas Bem.
Nicolas Bem.
Sebastian Zener.
Sebastian Zener.
Belen Landi.
Belen Landi.
And Marcelo Elias.
And Marcelo Elias.